So without further ado, I want to invite Karen to come up here and introduce tonight's speaker.
Thank you, David, and also thank you, Emily, and the rest of the organizing committee for setting up this amazing event. I'm really, really appreciate this opportunity to introduce the keynote speaker tonight, Dr. Jill Preetz, who is the Walwood Professor of Anthropology from Iowa State University, and she's also an affiliate of the Ecology and Evolutionary Biology graduate program there. Jill was an undergraduate at Texas State University and got her PhD at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. She has has received just about every possible teaching award it's conceivable to get, and many of you will have heard of the National Geographic Society. She was recognized as one of their emerging explorers. She has the usual long list of publications and research grants and invitations to give lectures, although this is a really good one too. But what really distinguishes Jill's record and why we're just so lucky to have her here tonight is that, and I'll say this really sincerely, she's one of the few people who has studied primates all over the world. She began studying chimpanzees in captivity, and then she saw that studying them in the wild would be more interesting. She's worked with tamarins in Peru, with vervet monkeys and pattus monkeys in Kenya, with spider monkeys, howler monkeys, and capuchin monkeys in Costa Rica, and then chimpanzees in West Africa. And it was actually about 11 years ago, right at the millennium, that Jill went to Senegal, and she's been working with the chimpanzees in Fongoli there ever since. And this site, she's going to tell us a lot about it today, and I'm really excited to hear it because every time I talk to Jill, there's something new and exciting, and like no one's ever seen these things before coming out of her research. But some things that she may not, you know, I really want to emphasize in advance is, first of all, how difficult this kind of research is. These are wild chimpanzees living in a faraway place in the middle of nowhere, and from our point of view, and you know, Jill has taken 4 years to get these animals to let her follow them, to habituate them. And what her study is unusual because it occurs in the savanna, which is where we think that some part of human evolutionary history occurred, and it's why I think she was asked to speak tonight, because so many of the insights about these chimpanzees tells us something not just about other chimpanzees and other primates, but also about the continuities and discontinuities between humans and other animals. And so it's going to be really, really special to hear Jill speak tonight, and please join me in welcoming her.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here. I've had a great day, and I am very happy to talk to you about my research. I do have a few videos that I hope will work. So, you know, I hope the lighting's okay. I don't know if we can turn down these lights anymore. But thank you, Karen, for that great introduction. And indeed, I'm interested in chimpanzees because I think they're perhaps the greatest primate, and very interesting in their own right. But as a biological anthropologist, I am very much interested in them as a sort of a model that helps provide insight into our own evolutionary history. And so I'll talk more about that. And what I'll do tonight is really highlight the findings that have come out of my site so far, about most of them anyway, and talk about the implications that my research has for the study of human evolution. So this is just to give you an idea of where my site is relative to other studies of chimpanzees. And so each of these represents a long-term chimpanzee study site. And I'll say that I think chimpanzees are probably the best studied mammal in the wild. And there are at least a dozen study sites where they've been researched for over 10 years. In some cases, like in Tanzania at Gombe, where Jane Goodall started her work in 1960, for over 50 years now. And so we know a lot about chimpanzees. But if you look at the map, you'll see that oftentimes, or for the most part, almost half of our study sites are situated in East Africa. There are less in West Africa. There I am up there. Fongoli is my study site. The Asterix site was a project where chimpanzees, where they tried to habituate chimpanzees in the 1970s, and they were not able to, and they ultimately abandoned that site. So really, you have three long-term study sites in West Africa, including mine. And another thing that I like to think makes my site a little special that Karen mentioned is that the chimpanzees I study live in a savanna. So if you're like me, I still think of this when I think of chimpanzees, Jane Goodall, and there's a chimp right there. My site is very different. And so I think you can see the yellow here on the map represents savanna habitat. And again, this is the main reason that I chose my study site, and I'm interested in what chimps in this habitat can tell us about human evolution. Because as Karen mentioned, we think that the earliest hominids or bipedal apes lived in a woodland savanna habitat. I'll talk more about the site, and you'll see photos throughout this talk of chimps at my site. This is one guy, and I'll just say I do give the chimps names, and this is Bandit. And so I am a little bit interested to some degree in our inner ape. And one way we do this is we use chimpanzees and other primates to define ourselves. And so we're interested in the differences between humans and bipedal apes and chimpanzees. But I'll also refer to a few surprising findings that indicate there are more similarities between chimpanzees and ourselves than we once thought. And that's been the case with studies of primates and chimpanzees as long as we've been studying them. So the savanna. Again, this is the type of habitat. I'll talk more about what a savanna is. But basically, it includes some sort of grass understory. So you can have a grassland habitat. And the Serengeti, for example, is a great example of a grassland habitat, but you can have also a woodland that is a savanna as well. And again, we think that there are some important pressures in the savanna that caused some of the changes that eventually led to our own species. And for years, primatologists and anthropologists have recognized the importance of studying primates in savanna, and so we have, and Karen can vouch for this, many, many studies of baboons, and baboons are savanna-dwelling primates. We know quite a bit about how monkeys, such as baboons, adjust and adapt to a habitat like a savanna. And these are chimps at my site. We don't know very much about how apes adjust and adapt to a savanna, and that's precisely why I began my studies at Fongoli. So chimpanzees are more closely related to us than they are to gorillas. We expect to see similar changes in closely related species. And so what I'm really trying to get at are the pressures, the problems that chimpanzees have in the savanna. So technically what I'm doing is I'm using chimpanzees as a model. It's a referential model. And one type of referential model would be saying, well, chimps do this, so maybe early humans did that. Well, that's one way to look at it. Maybe not the best way. Sometimes I can't help myself from doing that. But maybe a better way is to look at chimps at my site, compare them to chimps living at other sites, basically forested sites, and look at the differences. And many of the differences that I see between chimps at my site and chimps and forested sites can be linked back to the environment. And again, my goal is really trying to figure out what the most important stresses or problems are for chimpanzees at this site. And just to give you an idea, this is a shot taken during the early dry season. So you see a short grassland habitat in the front, and then in the back is a woodland. I'll try to show you a few more. And this is deceptively lush. And so these were all taken during the rainy season. It is quite beautiful during the rainy season. During the dry season, it looks like the moon or something. And so it's a very harsh environment, even though it might not look like it. You have grassland here. You have woodland up there on the right, and that's during the rainy season, so the trees actually have leaves. But for most of the year, they don't have leaves. And then on the left up here, you have a forest site and the type of habitat we think about when we think about chimps. But at Fongoli, that only accounts for about 3% of the home range of the chimps is forest. So you have very tiny patches of forest. And so I categorize these different types of habitat as to whether they're closed in terms of the tree crowns, the canopy, or whether they're open. Because again, we think that the earliest hominids, bipedal apes, and later hominids as well, inhabited a more open environment than a forest. And so at Fongoli, most of the habitats are open in terms of the canopy, especially during the dry season when you have no leaves. And then you also have some degree of anthropogenic disturbance. So the chimps that I study do live alongside people. And that's a whole other area of research that I do. I won't talk about it so much. But we say sympatric with people. They're not eaten. There's a taboo against eating chimpanzees, which, of course, is great. But the people do perform a shifting agriculture or horticulture. And so they do disturb the area to some degree. It's not to a great degree, but chimpanzees do have to take into account humans in terms of their ranging patterns. This just gives you a brief view of chimpanzees. It's a little film I'm going to hope to show during the late wet season. So what you see is a grassland habitat, and if you watch, there'll be a chimp that's going to stand up and look over the grass. There he goes. So this was a small party of chimps I was following. It's a little dark because it was at dusk, and they were actually worried about another party of chimps that they were trying to avoid. It was within their same community, but for some reason they didn't want to spend the night with those guys, and so that's what he was doing. So a little bit of background on the Fongoli chimps. So chimpanzees live in a community that is formed of individuals that know one another. They formed a close community, but within that community, they often split up into parties or subgroups, so you're not likely to find all of the individuals together at any one time. At Fongoli, you have a relatively small community. It's within the range of chimps that have been studied elsewhere, but we have anywhere between 29 and 36 individuals. Right now, we have between 30 and 32. We have a couple of peripheral males. And we actually have more males than females right now. And at other sites, oftentimes you find twice as many females as males. And this may be affecting behavior at the site. But what's interesting, or one of the differences we found so far, is that these guys are especially wide-ranging. So compared to chimps that live in forests, chimps at Fongoli have home ranges that are between 2 and 9 times larger. So at Gombe, for example, where Jane Goodall studied, chimps have a home range of about 8 to 12 square kilometers, and at Fongoli they have a home range that's at least 65, and I'd say probably 75 square kilometers, which means it's really hard to find these guys when you lose them. So just briefly, my study protocol involves following a single male from dawn to dusk, and so we'll go out and find where they've nested the night before. We'll have followed them there, and we'll follow them all day long for about 13 hours and then go back to our camp and repeat this protocol. If you lose these guys, you might be looking for a week or 10 days, and you really don't want to do that when it's hot. And I didn't mention the temperature. So it is a very hot place. During the dry season, it can be upwards of 115 degrees Fahrenheit. Most of the trees have lost their leaves, so there's hardly any shade, and the chimps get the good shade. And there are very few water sources. And so it's a pretty challenging place to work, but it's pretty amazing. So what are some of the problems that the chimps have to deal with? Well, heat's a big problem. And that's definitely something researchers appreciate. It is, like I said, a really hot place to work. And sometimes I'll carry up to 5 liters of water with me in a single day, and I still worry about running out of water. Well, they deal with heat in the extreme in terms of bushfires, and so this is interesting. It's rare that chimps encounter fires up close, but I've been with them a few times, unfortunately, when we have encountered a bushfire, and I'll just say the chimps are much better at dealing with fire than I am, so I just follow their lead so that I won't get burned up. But even a bigger problem for them is just daily temperature, and this may not look too surprising, but if you study chimps, then this looks pretty surprising probably, because chimps for a very long time were thought to be hydrophobic. They were thought to be afraid of water, And this stems largely from Jane Goodall's work in Tanzania. We know that some chimps will wade across streams to get to food and things like this, but chimps at my site love water. So what you see, it looks pretty lush here, but this is at the beginning of the rainy season. So the rains have started. This is at the edge of a plateau. The water has streamed down the plateau and filled this little rock pool, and the leaves have started to flush out, but the heat index, so you still have high temperatures, and now you have high humidity. So, for example, last year in June when I arrived, the heat index was 118. And so this is the type of heat that these guys are dealing with at this time of year, and they will actually compete over access to water. So I'll show you a video clip. And these are all adult males here. The alpha male is the guy that's approaching. And you see a female sitting off to the right. She won't get access for a while. So it's really interesting because you can sit next to this water hole and basically figure out the pecking order of 10 adult male chimps. It's really cool, at least I think. And I'm going to try to show you a video. And what you'll see, it's pretty brief, but the alpha male, the current alpha male, is going to come in and he displays over the water and he's going to chase a low-ranking male out. And then there's another male that won't be dissuaded. Yes, they definitely are habituated to us. So Karen mentioned this issue with habituation. It took 4 years. There he goes. And I really thought it might take between 5 and 10 years. I wasn't sure what to expect because Savannah chimps had never been habituated before. And so they're definitely familiar with us, but they're not habituated to other people. So if we take someone with us, they're okay by association, even though they're treated a little bit differently. They're a little nervous around them. But when they see villages, for example, they usually hide or they leave, and we have to do the same thing. So they're habituated to a few people, but not to people in general. Another way they deal with the heat is that they use caves. And I'm sorry, this looks sort of like one of those Bigfoot photos or something. But it's hard to take photos of chimps in caves. And for one thing, I do have a conservative protocol, and I try not to get too close. I always say they don't read my protocol, so they come closer. But I try to stay at 30 feet from them. So it wasn't until several years ago that we were able to get to the point where we could see them when they were in caves. But, you know, when I first started work at the site, my Senegalese field assistant told me the chimps use caves. I was like, oh, right, that sounds too good to be true. That's pretty cool. And in fact, we found feeding traces. We didn't see chimps for many years. I tried to put up those remote cameras, but they were too clever for that. And they never had their photo taken. But now I can follow them at least to the lip of the cave. And the caves are significantly cooler than other habitats. So I've put out remote temperature loggers and looked at that. And they socialize in caves. They'll take food into caves. They'll rest in caves. And this is another thing that they do compete over. So adult males will have first priority of access to caves, and the juveniles will be sort of stuck on the outskirts where we are, trying to get underneath a ledge or something like that. The high temperatures at the site really exacerbate what I think is the main limiting resource for chimpanzees here, and that's water. And Tony can correct me if I'm wrong, but I've heard, for example, once that chimps at Kibali sometimes don't even drink. Is that right? I can't imagine, because that is the resource that I would say is most important here. And so let me just go ahead and start this video while I talk about it. What you see here is a female digging for water. And other animals do this as well, and chimps in savanna habitats in Uganda do. So this is a female we call Farafa. And so she's digging down to the water table. And these streams go dry during the dry season, but they can extend the time they spend in these areas by several weeks, even up to a month, by digging down to the water table. What she's doing is digging for her juvenile and her infant. And the juvenile is capable of digging for himself, but he waits on mom. And then that's her adult son there. That blob in front is actually her adult son. So those are all her offspring, waiting on mom to dig. So it's always been assumed that savanna environments are very different in terms of food availability for primates, and especially apes, that are largely frugivorous. They feed on fruit. Fruit is their main food source. And if you look at chimps at Fongoli, they do feed on fruit like other chimps. In fact, they feed on just as many species of fruit as do chimps in living in forests. But there are some significant differences. And if you look at this big triangle there on the left, termites make up a very large portion of the diet, and that is something that is different. And so if you just compare Fongoli chimps to an average that I've calculated here based on chimps at other sites, we see that they not only eat more termites and more animal prey than chimpanzees elsewhere, but they eat less leaves and what we call terrestrial herbaceous vegetation, just ground vegetation. And this is not surprising to me because for 6 or 7 months out of the year, there are no leaves on the trees. And so they seem to be compensating by feeding on termites. Another similarity that the chimps at Fongoli have with chimps elsewhere, at least most chimpanzee communities, is that they use tools during feeding. And so on your right there is an adult male we call Mamadou, and he's termite fishing. And on the left is an example of what some call pseudo-tool use, because what he's doing is cracking open a fruit on a hard anvil. And I have a little video to show you of that. So it's not the greatest of view, but there's a female, and she's going to crack open a fruit on a rock anvil. That's Nene. So this is a baobab fruit. It's a hard husk fruit. It's got a woody husks. Baboons will bite that open. Chimps crack it open on rocks. They'll crack it open on tree limbs, but they're pretty choosy about where they will crack it open. So I think it's perhaps not traditionally tool use because they don't modify the substrate, but it involves some thinking nonetheless. And so what you see is that chimps use tools in these fairly challenging situations to get at termites, to get at biting ants, to get at these hard-husked baobab fruits. Another thing they do, and this is the most significant difference, I guess, that we've found so far, is that they actually use tools to hunt. And when we first reported this, there had been only one published sighting of chimpanzees using tools to hunt. And in fact, this was something that we used to define our own species. And, you know, we've had to revise the definition of our own species throughout the years as we find out that other animals use tools, other primates eat meat. Now other primates hunt with tools. And I'm going to go into some detail about tool use in hunting. I want to first talk a little bit about hunting in general. And so at every study site where chimps have been studied for a number of years, they hunt. And I'll just say there are some slightly graphic images because there's some, you know, prey items here, just so you know. So this is a male chimpanzee, Sibroot, and he's got a bushbuck fawn, and that's probably the largest prey that the chimpanzees feed on. And like chimpanzees at other sites, male chimps at Fongoli do chase down monkeys. And in fact, this guy is the oldest adult male and the lowest ranking adult male. He's the best hunter at the site. And in a minute, you'll see there's another older adult male that's following him. He wants a little bit of meat, and he eventually does get some meat. But so in terms of male hunting behavior, the chimps at Fongoli are similar to what you see at other sites. They'll chase down monkeys. They'll grab bushbuck fawns, although it seems like females do that as well. Doesn't seem so. Does not seem to be the case. Oh, these guys look very different to me. These guys look as different to me as most of you do, but that to me, I'm sort of, you know, a little weird maybe. But if you look really close, these guys are very different looking. Did you ask me about status? Oh, status depends on a lot of things. It depends on strength to some degree, it depends on age to some degree, but it depends on your buddies. Probably more than anything, it depends on your friends. And he's got friends, but his friends are low ranking too. He's at that age, but you know, he's doing fine. If we look closely, what we see again, so you see these monkeys here on the left, and I will say that I studied two of these monkey species for 2 years in Kenya, so I'm a little torn every time one is taken by a chimp. But my loyalties do lie with chimps these days. What's interesting and different is that little critter on the right. A galago is a primate. It's a Proximian primate. It's actually quite small, about 200 grams. It's nocturnal, so it's active at night, and during the day, it sleeps in these hollow cavities. And this is the main prey item of chimpanzees at my site. And this is the primate or the prey that they hunt with tools. So I'll talk more about that, but basically they fashion tools, they stab them into these hollows and extract bush babies from these hollows. And again, so males will chase down these monkeys like chimps do elsewhere, but females who almost always have an infant can't. And females will engage in bush baby hunting and also adolescents. But I'm kind of giving away, I'm giving you the ending, so let me move on. So I'll just tell you a little bit about the behavior. So it's, you know, it's, compared to the kinds of things we do, it's fairly simple. But it's systematic, and they have a series of steps they go through. So they usually make their tool out of a green branch, not a dead branch, not one they find, but one they tear off of a tree. And then they'll strip the leaves off. What they'll do is usually break off the end of the branch, the terminal end that's flimsier, so you have a stouter stick. And then in certain cases, they actually trim the tip of the tool, and I'll just show you a little graph of the steps. And so this is somewhat conservative as well, because I never score the tool as being trimmed unless I see it trimmed. And so on that photo there, you have a tool on the bottom that's been trimmed with the teeth, and the tool on the top has not. And while it's easy to, when you find a tool, to see whether all the leaves have been stripped off, again, it's not so easy to tell whether a tool has been trimmed by the teeth, because the tip of the tool is often in pretty bad shape after they stab it into the hollow. Oftentimes it has bush baby hair sticking to it, so it's kind of hard to see what went on with the tip. So that's a pretty conservative estimate, but definitely some individuals trim the tip of the tool, and oftentimes these are adolescent females. So I hope this works. This is a video of an adult male using a tool, and it's not the most exciting hunt, I'll say, but it is one of the best examples of tool making. And then also note that after he puts the tool into the hollow, he sniffs it. So that's something that they usually do as well. So this is an alpha male. And excuse our photography, but there are always sweat bees around. I think she'll stop in a minute. There were a lot of sweat bees. So in a minute, I think he's going to pull it out. He's going to smell it. And I will say, when we first reported our findings, we'd only seen one adult male exhibit this behavior, and now we've seen five adult males exhibit it. There's only one adult male, though, that's exhibited it more than once. But the alpha male did, I think this was in 2009, that we saw the alpha male actually hunt with the tool. So we reported our findings about tool-assisted hunting or spear hunting in 2007, and again, this was novel in terms of chimpanzee behavior. There had been one reported case published of a female in Tanzania rousing a squirrel with a stick, and we saw 22 cases. We only saw one success at the time, and we were able to recover 12 tools. The one success was by this young chimp lady there, Tumbo, and then I wanted to update you on what we see now. And so as of December 2010, I just got this data together, we've seen 27 individuals exhibit the behavior. We have around 129 hunts. And with a larger sample size, we have a 9% success rate, which doesn't sound really great, but as far as predators go, it's not too bad. It's about the same as lone chimpanzees that hunt in forests, for example, in West Africa. But if you look at individual success rate, TM is Tumbo. Again, that's the lady there, chimp lady. And she's got a 33% success rate. She's the most prolific hunter and the most successful hunter. And she was an adolescent in this study. And she's since had an infant in 2008. She had her first infant. And then there's some other details for those archaeological types. And mean tool length is around 61 centimeters, although tools can be, the longest is about this tall, and that's a real pain to carry around all day long to bring it back to the camp. And then mean bout length is pretty short, so 4 minutes, so I think we're missing a lot of information. Yes. What are their predators? That's a good question. Their predators, sadly, most of their predators have been exterminated. So lions are no longer here. Every once in a while you get a leopard, but one predator that they do encounter, a potential predator, is a spotted hyena, which is one of my favorite animals as well. So it's pretty exciting. But they don't have to worry about as many predators as chimps at other sites. And even though humans are not major predators of chimps here, they do treat them like a threat to some degree. So that's probably a stressor as well. So that's a good question. Not the same traditional set of predators. This breaks down the hunting behavior, and I'm going to talk about this in more detail. But so when you look at hunting in chimps at every other site, what you see is that males hunt for the most part. Not the case here with bush baby hunting. And just to break it down, according to males, females, and immatures, you seem to see a lot, and you do see more hunting by immatures. And really what it is that adolescent females and adolescent males are hunting more than expected. So if you look at expected versus observed behaviors, the significant differences are that adult males hunt less than expected, and adolescent males and females hunt more than expected. In absolute terms, females, adult females also hunt more than males, but relative to their representation in the community. And I should say that this is just an estimate of what we should expect to see, and it's based on how many males are in the community and how many females are in the community. A better way to do it, but I couldn't get it done for this talk, is to look at actual subgroup or party size, which I had done on the previous slide. And so to see how often we're following parties with males versus females, because I do selectively follow males and not females. If I have time, I'll talk about that more. And another thing to take into account is that females are more timid than males. Still to this day, some females are timid around observers. They're okay when they're with males, but yet they still avoid human observers to a greater degree. So I really think that we probably are, you know, to some degree getting at what adult males are doing, but adult females, I know that we have a long way to go. Adolescent females and males are better habituated because they've grown up with us, and so we're just this weird part of their environment. So, and then younger male and younger female here are just juvenile and infant males and females. And I probably won't have time, but afterwards I can talk more about this. But we've seen some really interesting examples of infants hunting. It's kind of funny because they have like an infant-sized tool, but they go through the proper channel, the proper steps, etc. But we've seen that a bit as well. So one hypothesis I have about this tendency for adolescents to hunt with tools more than adult males, for example, is that if you think about access to meat and meat sharing, adolescents are on the bottom of the list. So juveniles and infants can get meat from their mothers. Adult males are more likely to share with adult males and adult females, but adolescents are really out of luck. And so they have to be a little more creative about getting access to protein. That's one hypothesis I have anyway. But what's interesting is that each of these individuals has been classified as an adolescent during our study and is now an adult. So we can now follow them. And we have seen some interesting changes in that this guy, for example, David, is quite high ranking right now. And we've seen him hunt less than he used to. And granted, it's a small sample size. He's hunted only about 11 times total. But his hunting behavior in terms of tool use has dropped off. The thing is that now these young guys on the right are able to run down monkeys. And so you see Bo up there in the upper right has a vervet monkey that he's caught. So it may be that once they've gotten to the point where they're better at hunting monkeys, which is a larger package, then they'll switch to that. So that's just one hypothesis. And then this gal here up on the upper left is one who has an infant that's also been observed to hunt with her little tiny infant-sized tool. But that's something that we're going to follow through time as well to see if the infants of hunters become hunters themselves. So I've just got a brief video here of a male, again, a little graphic, vervet monkey. And so a male has gotten a vervet monkey, and he's an older male. And these two males that are flanking him are actually higher ranking than he is. But when they obtain prey, there's respect for the hunter. So what's interesting and something that we're looking at now is sharing or food taking. And at almost every chimpanzee site where they've been studied, they not only eat meat, but they share meat. But they rarely share plant food. But at this site, they do share plant food. And they also share meat extensively. Another difference is that females will have access to meat because of the bush baby hunting, and females will share meat as well. He's trying to get away from those other guys, and they're not going to give him a second. And so that's begging behavior on the part of chimpanzees, just in your face watching you. And you can see that KL has his hand. He's ready. His finger's broken, so he can't bend it. But he's ready to get a piece of vervet and doesn't get it. Later on he does, though. Bilbo had that monkey. This was literally the day before I left in December, before I left Senegal. And he had that monkey for hours. And the guy there on your left followed him around for hours, hoping that he would abandon it. They rarely scavenge at any site, and we haven't seen any scavenging at this site. So yeah, just fresh meat, and it's definitely a hot commodity. It goes really fast. One thing I wanted to talk briefly about was the seasonality of hunting, and it is a seasonal behavior. And so I have various hypotheses about this too. Some of it may be an observer effect. I'm here every year from May through July, and I tend to be observant. I will even admit myself, I think I am. But there is definitely some seasonality. I've also been at the site throughout the entire year. Last year I was there for the whole year, and I would see maybe one sample in February and March, etc. So there's a real seasonal effect, and so we have some ideas about why that might be. This is the rainy season, June, July, August, September. That's Frito up there waiting across a creek. And so it does coincide with some climatic changes. The only thing that you need to look at in this slide is this also indicates an increase in termite fishing at this time of year. So an increase in termite fishing, an increase in bush baby hunting. And it may have to do with nutrition. There's some nutrient that they're lacking. And I have a student who's going to start examining that for her dissertation work this August. But it could also have to do with the behavior of the termites themselves and the bush babies themselves, also something I'm considering. Another thing, though, that you see at this time of year is that party size is large. And so on the right, you have party size of the chimpanzees during the wet season. On the left, you have dry season party size. And so that's just number of individuals on that axis. And this is an interesting finding in general because these are all chimp study sites. What I've done is average these sites. These are all forced sites. And come up with that value there on the far right. If you look at Fongoli, the community is much more cohesive. So usually, you know, talk about the chimpanzee community in terms of the fact that you'll hardly ever see all chimps in one place at one time. Well, that's not the case at Fongoli. During the early rainy season, everyone will travel together, like other primate groups. And this is really different. So you see a very different value for Fongoli chimps in terms of their absolute party size, and relative party size is just in relation to community size. So almost half of the chimps at any one time are together at Fongoli. And when we first published our data, we hypothesized that the hunting with tools could have been due to competition, that during these times when you have very large party sizes, you also have competition between individuals. That definitely could be the case. But I'm also wondering about the behavior of the bush babies themselves. That's something I'm interested in, and I would love to have a student come out to my site and study bush babies, even though they might be eaten. Probably not very encouraging. So I just wanted to sort of summarize, and then if I have time, I wanted to talk about one more thing. So what have we found so far? Well, there are distinct differences between savanna chimpanzees and forest-dwelling chimpanzees, maybe not surprising. But we weren't quite sure until we were able to habituate these chimps. So they are more cohesive than chimps living in forests, but yet they are wider ranging. They are limited by things like water availability and by heat. and they use caves and water to cool themselves down. One thing that I didn't mention is that they also seem to rest a lot more than chimps at other sites. In fact, if you look at them, they look like gorillas on paper, which is maybe a little embarrassing for chimp people. But they rest a lot more, but come to find out that they also move around and feed at night during phases of the full moon. And so that's something that we suspected when we would get to the nest site in the morning and they'd be gone way before light. And or we would find someone walking in the dark as we were walking to meet them, something like that. And so last year when I was there, I was able to spend about 30 nights out with the chimps and record their behavior at night. And so I'm just now kind of writing that up. And then in terms of diet, hunting with tools systematically seems to occur only at this site. And one thing that I didn't mention is, I left this out, is that the main prey item of chimpanzees in general, the red colobus monkey, is not at this site. So again, I think this ties back into the savanna habitat. At most other sites, chimpanzees have red colobus monkeys. It's just too dry for red colobus monkeys at this site. And what we see is that they turn to other prey species like the galagos and that they emphasize insect prey like termites. Hours and hours feeding on termites. So what do I think this means for human evolution, the studies of human evolution? Well, in many ways, it just confirms or supports, I would say not confirms, hypotheses that have been set forth before that recognize water availability specifically as a very limiting factor, and heat exacerbates that. So this limits the ranging behavior, at least of quadrupedal apes like chimpanzees. It limits their activity during the heat of the day. They just rest for hours and hours. And then in terms of protein availability, this is interesting, and we're now at the level, as I mentioned, that we're going to examine nutritional aspects of their diet specifically. And so did early hominids adapt to similar pressures? I'll just say yes, I think so. And what I have one more thing I'd like to talk about if I have time. Do I have time? Basically, what has happened in my 10 years with the Fongoli chimps is I went out with a question about feeding ecology and ranging behavior, and I still address that question. But the chimps keep doing these things, like hunting with tools and using caves and using water, etc. And so then I just go where they go. So I just follow their trajectory. And they end up doing things every year that cause me to sort of delve into these new areas. And empathy is one that I kind of just started thinking about lately because of a really specific instance. And so I'll just go ahead and tell you there's a nice ending to this story. But what happened in January 2009 is that I got a call from my field assistant, and he had seen this baby in town. And it turns out she was from our field site. So he calls me on a Saturday, and he said that he found an infant in town that some young men were trying to sell, and he thought it was from our group. And so I wrote him back and I said, can you send me a photo and let me see if I can leave here? It was the beginning of the semester. So I asked my chair and he said, sure. No problem. So basically what you would see is that my field assistant was able to get this infant. He confiscated the baby. And I was allowed to go over there, and it took me 2 days. I got there, it turns out, 5 days after the infant had been taken. And what usually happens when you have infants taken from wild primate mothers is that the mother is killed. And this is what I thought probably happened in this case. And so I didn't have much hope of finding the mother, but after I got out there, we took the infant and we went out to the site, and lo and behold, we found the mother, and she was wounded. What had happened was some young men were out hunting for warthogs, they said, and their dogs treated a chimpanzee. And what I think probably happened is that when the people came along, she was too afraid to stay in the tree, and she jumped out and the dogs attacked her, and the infant either fell off or was pulled off. So the mother was wounded. We had this little baby who, it turns out, was only 9 months of age, and our plan was to take her back, and we hadn't heard of this ever happening before, And we were a little bit afraid of how the males would react. So male chimpanzees are at least 5 times stronger than humans. They have these really big teeth, et cetera. And we just weren't sure of how they would react. So our plan was to take the baby up and leave her maybe 50 meters away from the group and then let them find her. But the baby was so tiny when we approached the group and we could hear them pant hooting and vocalizing, she didn't do anything. She basically was just holding on to us. And maybe she was in a weakened state for having been separated from her mother for five days, even though we fed her. So we had to move right up to the chimpanzees and basically put her on the ground. So we had this sack, and we put her on the ground, and she tumps over. And so we have to go back and sort of leave her there. And all the while, the chimps are eating figs. And it turns out that an adolescent male appeared to be the first to see us. So the adolescent male, as soon as we left, the baby came and picked the baby up and immediately carried her to the mother. And so the mother came down, grabbed the baby, and then chimps were just, you know, like crazy. They all came around the baby to inspect the baby. They probably thought the baby stunk because she smelled like us, and they were all smelling the baby. And then the mother took the baby back, and I followed them for the rest of the day. My assistants went back. What was interesting, and where empathy comes in, is that the same adolescent male, there he is, up there on the left, that's Mike. He's very confident for a chimp, even an adolescent male chimp. That is his personality all over. And that's Amy, that's her after. So what Mike was the one that retrieved Amy and took her to the mother. What was even more amazing, that was just a miraculous thing. I can say, I said I can never ask for another thing in my life ever after being able to do that. What was even just almost as interesting is that later on in the day, in the late afternoon, and this was the dry season, the chimp started traveling, but Tia was wounded. So she would walk about 10 meters, 30 feet or so, and put the baby down, stop, rest for a while, pick the baby up, walk again. So she wasn't keeping up with the group. There was one adult male that stayed back with her, and then Mike came back, picked up the baby, and carried the baby for Tia until they got to the nesting site, and then handed the baby back, or let the mother take the baby back. And so my field assistants came back to camp that night, and everyone, besides just being shocked that we were able to reintroduce Amy, everyone was equally shocked that Mike had carried the baby, because that's not normally something adolescent males do. And we do know that Mike is not related to Tia or Amy, at least according to matrilineal relatedness. And then the next day, he did it again. In the afternoon, Tia was unable to keep up with the group, and she kept setting the baby down. And then he carried the baby again. So that, to me, was a clear sign of empathy in apes. And I was surprised at how much controversy there was in the literature about whether or not apes and other animals have empathy. So it was a learning experience for me. And I will end there with that little nice story and say thank you very much again for having me. It was a real pleasure, and I can answer any questions. I know you guys have some questions here. Thanks. Do I have time for questions?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. No, that's a good question. Because until recently, I had never heard of a chimpanzee swimming. I don't know if you have, Tony, but I actually had someone contact me from South Africa, and he sent me a photo of a chimp underwater, a captive chimp, someone's pet. But as far as I know, he's not swimming. He's sinking underwater. Still a bizarre thing. But, yeah, I can't imagine them. They are limited by big bodies of water. There is, so at my site, at the peak of the dry season, there are probably 3, sometimes 2 water sources. One is a tiny spring that's literally in mud puddle, and they have to you know, scrape out leaves and things like that. The other is the Gambia River, and it's a fairly large river. It never runs dry, but they are hesitant to drink at that, and there are crocodiles there. We don't have the big crocs left there like they do in other parts of Africa, but they are hesitant to drink at the Gambia more so than at these tiny water sources.
Oh,
she had a question earlier too. Oh, right. That's a good question. So I've had a student that looked at part of Mike's genome so far, part of his DNA. And she can tell that he's not related to Tia. He's not a brother of Tia. So he might be related to Amy, say, if he's related to her father. But he's less related than, say, a brother. He's not Tia's brother. He's not Amy's brother. But he might be like an uncle or something like that. But that's a good question. Yes. They are, to some degree. It seems like water first, then food. So food comes after water because actually the period of greatest fruit availability is at the end of the dry season. But you do have these slightly smaller parties during the dry season than the wet season. But so, I mean, it's interesting. We're working on ranging now. So they're really restricted to these water sources. They radiate out. But the food around the water sources is depleted. But once the rains start again, they can drink from puddles on the plateau and that sort of thing. It's not that there's more food at that time, but they can all stay together because of the water. So it's an interesting relationship. But yeah, food does come in there. It just sort of lags after water. Uh-huh. Well, I mean, it's similar to some communities, but yeah, I mean, there are communities where you have twice as many males. I mean, it might be because of an instance like this with Tia and Amy. And when I've talked about this with some people at Karen today, I study males because of that risk. And so I am really interested in female feeding ecology. It's what I study with monkeys. But when I first started working at Fongoli, I at first, you know, explored whether or not chimps were hunted. They're rarely hunted, but if someone has an opportunity to capture a baby for the pet trade, they might take it, like the young guys did. And so I'm wondering if maybe over the years, because a female chimp is not going to reproduce until she's 13, and then every 5 years or so, I wonder if over the years maybe that's what has happened. I'm not 100% sure. We did have last week a new adolescent female come into the group, and that's the first time that we've seen that in several years. And so there are some limitations to dispersal as well, because we're sort of up against a fairly large town. But I in my mind, I've always kind of wondered about, you know, this targeting of females for the infant, for the pet trade, and that's, yeah, it's why I don't follow females. Don't get them really used to being targeted like males. Oh, I see. Not that I think males are expendable. But, yeah. I mean, what's interesting, and right now we have a pretty small sample size, but we're, you know, over time we can look at male-female sex ratio. I mean, what's really interesting, and I didn't get to talk about it as much, is that there are a lot more adolescent males than females now. We have one adolescent female now with this other one, technically a second, but there are a lot more adolescent males. And so before the last, three or four infants were born, it seemed like there was just males everywhere. So there was some skewed birth sex ratio, but now we've seen a number of females born as well. So we'll see. I mean, hopefully at some point I'll have a large enough sample size to tell. Yes. All right, Tumbo. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting. I will say that Mike is one of the most prolific hunters as well. But he is growing up. And in 2009, I can't think of the exact number offhand, but Mike was probably the second or the third highest ranked hunter in terms of frequency. That fell off last year. He's very much interested in the ladies nowadays. And so you do see some changes. So that's why it's so interesting to follow these adolescent males. But yeah, there are differences in, you know, not to say personality, but temperament maybe. And Mike is one that now we've seen him not carry infants extensively like Amy, but one day I looked over and I saw Tumbo's baby, the huntress, and I was like, what, that's just odd to me. It was because it was an adolescent male carrying this baby. And Mike just seems to be attracted to infants as well. That's another explanation. He's an orphan himself, even though his mother died after he was weaned. And so I wonder if he's maybe attracted to infants because he didn't have siblings, that sort of thing. But you do see, you know, what I would call temperament differences, but the sample size is small, so I can't quite say that. I can say it here, but maybe not in print yet. I was just trying to figure who did. Oh, that was interesting. And I was talking with Tony Goldberg about that because they're not quite like chimps in Uganda that will always dig, even when there's flowing water. They will drink some water that would make me sick and has made me sick when I've been foolish enough to drink it. The stagnant water. They'll usually dig a little spot next to stagnant pools. And we were talking about the heat issue, and I didn't really think so much. I was glad to hear that. I've thought about it sometimes, and I'm like, oh, wait, maybe not. But, you know, maybe it's just the temperature of the water, but also whether or not it's stagnant. Even the running water that I've tested at the site is contaminated, and they're you know, obviously better at dealing with those parasites than I am. That is something that they were definitely, I would say, I guess, worried about or thinking about. So we have seen like this young female come in from another group, and normally it's females who leave the group in chimpanzees who leave their community and move on to another community. Not always, but it does seem like we've seen, based on observation of two young females and also the mitochondrial DNA, that there are females staying in the community at a higher rate than even at Gombe. I believe it was like 40% of females stayed or something like this. So that's, especially with the small community, there's a PhD student that's looking at that right now, but that's definitely, worrisome for conservation purposes. And again, they are limited. There's at least one community that they can, you know, exchange genes with, but otherwise they're cut off. But that's something that we're working on, and it seems to be problematic in Senegal in general, is dispersal opportunities for these guys. Yes. Oh, safety concerns. Oh, I do and I don't. I do, but I don't ever get really worried about it. So David, I showed you a photo of David. He's a guy, young guy that grew up. He ran into me in November, and I'd hoped to never have that contact. And he basically used me as a shield because he was trying to advance above a higher-ranking male. And that male is older. And the older males are not as comfortable with us. And so David chased this male and then came right back by me. And I was in a trail in a big grass patch. And David had just passed me. In fact, I was following him. So he knew very well where I was. And he ran by and just brushed up against me. I thought he was going to knock me flat, but he didn't. And the other male stopped. And David won and everything. It was great. But he used me. That was interesting. You know, I don't want contact. I'm worried about disease. But then a few weeks later, David displayed at me and came right up here and was bipedal and wanted me to, you know, be afraid and everything because the female was ignoring him, Tita was ignoring him and everything. And I had to make him back down. And I was a little nervous because I thought, wow, I hope he backs down because I'm really going to lose if he doesn't. And then it's like exciting. But it is worrisome. I worry about students because I know that he does not know yet how strong he is. And I can bluff. I've been around chimps a lot. I'm pretty good at displaying. So I won that one. But, you know, students especially, and my students are probably more worried about me than chimps, and they know that they should not disturb the chimps. And so sometimes they might be hesitant to make a chimp stand down in that scenario. But students are not normally in that situation because I make them go out with field assistants. One thing you also see is that the chimps are more likely to display at females than males. So my Senegalese field assistant is smaller than I am, and I bet he doesn't display as well as I do, but still they don't try to, you know. No, I can't do that. Later, maybe after I have a beer or two. She had another question. Oh, yes, I always do. I think I'm very overprotective of the chimps, so I'm very concerned, but we've been lucky, knock on wood, so far. We've had quite a few births, and we have yet to see a case of infant mortality. And this thing with Amy, returning Amy to her mom, was just miraculous. So again, wow, so far so good. Yeah. In some cases, yeah. Well, there are a couple of different things about that. So one thing is I do think, so what you see are some differences between males and females, I think, that where I think males are more tolerant of female behavior. So I talked a little about sharing, but really in some cases it's taking. So females can take food from males. Females can supplant males from termite fishing sites. And so in feeding situations, males will let females be dominant to them. That seems to be a little more common here, and I wonder if it's a strategy of some of the males. So we had this one example with Tumbo, the good hunter. And there was a really low-ranking male that was following her around. She was an estrus. And this doesn't always happen just when they're an estrus. But she happened to be an estrus, and he was really fond of her. And she kept ignoring him. And he, at one point, he was sitting there, and he was making termite fishing tools. And I don't know if he was intending to fish or was he intending to make them for her. But she would reach over and take the tool and fish. And he would make another one. And she would reach over and take the tool and fish. And she continued to ignore him. But so I wonder if you see another, obviously other primates exhibit the same type of behavior, and chimps do as well, but I wonder if that's one reason why we see some of the male tolerance of female behavior that we see here. The other thing is about the peripheral males is that this is not necessarily something that's common in chimps at all, because you do have what appears to be, you do have lethal aggression between chimp communities and other sites. We haven't seen that here. I wouldn't expect it just based on this gigantic home range and the fact that whereas males patrol borders in East Africa and other places as well, the chimps here are not likely to run across other chimps even if they were to patrol borders. And so I think that the low density of chimps, these big home ranges, and the low density enables males to be peripheral at Fongoli, whereas you're not going to find peripheral males in Uganda, at Kibali. But what's interesting is both of the males that are peripheral were former alphas, and they're not tolerated in the larger community anymore. And so, I mean, I was there watching, again, David. I always seem to be with him. And all of a sudden, I saw the alpha. I hadn't seen him in a year and a half, the former alpha, and I just was shocked. And he was a little nervous of me, and both he and David were very quiet. And they greeted one another as they would normally, but no vocalization. They just kind of went through very soft. And then they went off together, and the rest of the community didn't see this other guy, the former alpha, until the next day when all the males chased him away. So that's a really interesting aspect, too. And I think it's only possible because of the savannah situation, the fact you have low density. It's a really long answer to that question. Sorry. Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, one thing that we've seen is really erratic weather patterns. And in Senegal, in general, you've seen a reduction in rainfall. And so rainfall is less than 1,000 millimeters. You know, in the 70s, when they did the work at Asterisk, it was... even then, there was higher levels of rainfall. But some years we'll have really heavy rainfall. People's crops were ruined and that sort of thing. So it does affect the chimps' behavior. I don't have a really good handle on it yet. I feel like I need more time. And again, you'll have then droughts certain years. So it's hard to say. But we've definitely, even since I've been there, I've been able to see changes and some pretty extreme weather patterns there. Mm-hmm.
Upper rank of mail.
You know, I think that. I mean, you know, they're friends, I would say. The guy that was the best hunter, his closest coalition partner is also a fairly low-ranking male. There's a mid-ranking male that all the other males love to groom and like to have him as a coalition partner. But what's interesting is I had another student do some, this is a little off topic, but do some work on infant, affiliation with infants. And these low-ranking males were the ones that played more with infants, that wouldn't say care, but they affiliated more with infants, they groomed with infants, and that was sort of another example maybe of male strategy. You know, there is, all of the males groom at various times and this sort of thing, but definitely you see some affiliation between age cohorts and then kinship. There's some kinship ties as well, so the second highest ranking male, his younger brother, that's David, has risen up very quickly through the ranks because of his help. So, yeah, I mean, it's fairly fluid, but... Okay. Yeah, maybe I'll answer one more question. How about that?
Okay.
Yes. That's a really good question because it's interesting because, you know, I definitely think there's learning. There are examples of learning at my site. But the longer I study these guys, the more similarities I see with chimpanzees in West Africa. So if you look at the chimpanzee subspecies, the West African subspecies is set quite a ways apart, genetically speaking, from the other subspecies. And so these similarities violate my assumptions about chimps in a savanna habitat. So I expect, you know, interbirth interval, the time between births, successive births of a female, to be long, because they think it's such a stressful habitat. You know, they must have a long interbirth interval. No, they don't. They have a pretty short one. It's similar to West African chimps. Females tend to be swollen. Females have estrous swellings, and they tend to have estrous swellings sooner after they've given birth and for longer periods, and that's similar to chimps. Other chimps in West Africa, in terms of the sharing or the t- tolerated theft and this sort of thing. That's also that it's something that seems like it's more characteristic of West African chimps. The problem is, though, that you really only have a few sites in West Africa, literally like three. And at one of the sites, Basu, you have a chimp community that's completely isolated from other chimp communities, so you can't look at any of the dispersal type questions or aggression between groups or anything like that. But yeah, I'm surprised by some of the findings. I'll have these assumptions about their behavior based on the savanna habitat, and then they'll violate those. And well, I mean, that's interesting. I have this one example, at least one, that I saw myself, and then a student added another to this. But I think if it would have been humans, you would have said it's an example of teaching almost. And so one thing that does set us apart is that we actively teach people, other students and young and et cetera, and most other animals don't actively teach. There are some examples, but literally like a half a dozen, like meerkats and cheetahs and things like this. And so active teaching seems to be pretty rare, and in chimps it's seen just a few times. But there was a case in which this female was hunting, and then her infant went in and was sort of playing around with the tool and then broke it, and the female made another one and kind of waved it at the infant, but didn't let her have it, and went put it back in and left it for her, and then she went and fooled around with it some more, and she ended up making this baby-sized tool for herself, finally, and she went through all the steps correctly. And it seemed like it was a demonstration anyway. So I think there's quite a bit of learning, but again, I've read some of the papers on the fact that you can come up with explanations for these so-called cultural behaviors based on genetics as well. And, you know, I'm definitely open to that. Another long answer, sorry.
It's great. I'm sure everybody would really like to thank you for a very interesting talk. And
thanks.